This episode is brought to you in part by Swim. Here's the thing about wishlist apps. Most of them just sit there. A customer saves a product, and then nothing happens. Swim actually activates that data. When someone wishlists a product, you could trigger price drop or back-in-stock alerts and feed that intent directly into Klaviyo or your CRM. You're not guessing what people want, because they've told you. Plus, customers can share wishlists for gifts, and your team can view them to offer personalized service online or in-store. And unlike cart abandonment, wishlist data is permission-based. These are people raising their hand saying, "Hey, I want this, just not right now." Swim's been around for over a decade. It powers 45,000 stores and installs in about 5 minutes. You could try it for free today at getswym.com/Kurt. That's getswym.com/Kurt. Today on the Unofficial Shopify Podcast, we're going to talk influencer marketing with someone who is providing that service for themselves in their own store, Muskox Flannels, and as part of an agency that has been doing it for what appears to be almost 20 years, which I'm doing the math on that. I'm like, man, how long has this been around? But we'll get into the story. An incredible guest, fun guest, Brad Hoos, who's going to join us from Outloud Group, Outloud Talent, and Muskox Flannel. Brad, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
Kurt, I'm doing great. It is an honor and a pleasure to be here. I have listened to your podcast for many years. My team has received many emails, texts, Slacks with links to the episodes over the years. So I'm grateful to be on here and give back a small amount to this fantastic community here.
You made my day. I'm thrilled to hear it. It's always fun when you get like a listener who is successful and then becomes a guest. You know, it's just great to hear those stories and discover like, oh, here's someone else's success I, you know, totally unintentionally became a part of a little bit.
If you're like me, you probably get a lot from this podcast. So let me say this from a guest perspective, which maybe is a little unorthodox, but hopefully you're listening and you've got a lot out of this podcast over the months and years that you've listened to it, or hopefully at the end of the episode today, leave a review, because I know it helps Kurt and he's great and selfless and won't ask it very often. So hopefully we can all help Kurt here as well, because I know how much I have been helped by Kurt and this great podcast over the years.
Oh, God, thank you. It is such a relief. I hate promoting myself. Truly, I do. So for someone else to ask for the reviews on my behalf, you have done me a great favor here. But okay, you know, enough about how fabulous I am and how large my head will be. I want to know about this, how you've been doing influencer marketing for 18 years. You know, you have a Shopify store, Muskox Flannel, but that's a recent thing, right?
It is fairly recent. Yeah, that's been around for about 5 or 6 years. We launched that right around COVID, right before COVID. But in terms of influencer marketing at the Outloud Group, my business partner, Joel, started Outloud nearly 20 years ago, and I've been involved with him since 2014. So I don't always like to do the math on that, but we are definitely OGs in the influencer world and have seen a lot of trends come and go, and done a lot of interesting things over the years, made a lot of mistakes, and I think we've had a few successes along the way too.
So saying this started 18 years ago and you joined in 2014, all right, now the math, you know, the math on that timeline starts to make a little more sense. 2014, that's when Instagram is really taking off. But, you know, and YouTube's already been around, you know, for many years at this point. But, you know, take me back there. I want to hear it, you know, joining it, how it got started, et cetera.
Yeah. So my business partner, Joel Beckett, amazing guy. He was working as a high school teacher in Southwest Detroit. And on the side, he had a history podcast because he was really into history. And over time, podcast picks up some traction. He gets interest from advertisers. They start to negotiate. Things start going well. And this is right around the time of 2008 when, you know, Lehman and the collapses and the banking crisis. And, you know, the bottom kind of drops out of the economy and what people are willing to spend on marketing, because there's so much uncertainty. And brand comes back to him and says, hey, I'm sorry, we can only pay you 10% of what we had agreed to because of all the pressure that we're having, all the reasons that I just mentioned. They're like, but we do have a little bit more budget. So if you have other podcasts, we'd be interested in those. And so Joel, being the enterprising, smart chap that he was, went out and found a couple of other podcasts for this and took a commission as part of that. And I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting. And so got really, you know, podcast is huge. We can get into that. We still do, you know, a lot of podcasts massively influential. But at that time, you know, started to do a little bit more and more around podcast and helping some agencies find podcasts because it was very, very fragmented at the time. And then YouTube sprung up and became a thing and started to mature marginally past, you know, cat videos and a few like viral moments. And Joel loved it because it was really easy to find the email addresses of the creators. And
how so?
Well, because in YouTube, you know, if you go to a creator's page and if you click on about or about, depending on which side of the border you're on, you can get a chance to see the contact information of the creator. And so it was really easy to send an email. And now those emails of creators at scale tend to get very much flooded or managed by a manager or agent. But back then, you know, doing brand deals was quite unique and was really able to drive efficiency of getting in touch with creators, in this case, YouTube, as opposed to podcast. And so Joel carved out his own niche in that, which was really fascinating. And he started to get more and more traction. Largely was working for other agencies where he was kind of like white labeled doing different things. And he started to work with some brands directly, including like Crunchyroll as well. And did a ton of work with Audible. And so I got connected to Joel through a mutual friend and was immediately very intrigued, right? I knew nothing about influencer marketing. Yeah, a couple degrees in engineering, worked as a management consultant, and then was working with a VC, venture capital fund, and thought this was like just super interesting. And Joel and I immediately clicked, and I started to consult with him a little bit. And fast forward 7 months, and I was partnering with Joel on trying to build up this influencer agency. And then fast forward a whole bunch of years, we're a team of about 65 folks. We're global now, certainly work across four major platforms: YouTube, TikTok, podcast, and Instagram as well. But yeah, the beginning, it really came from just putting yourself out there, adapting when opportunities presented, and continued to pull the string and evolve with the industry. And influencer marketing has certainly evolved a lot in the last 10 to 15 years.
So, I mean, if that's so successful, why go through the hassle of starting your own Shopify store with Muskox Flannels?
That's a good question. Well, one, I think we're sickos, we're gluttons for punishment. So anyone who's started their own company trying to sell anything knows it's hard, right? It's not an easy endeavor. But
call it a hustle, but yeah, it's more like a grind at times.
Yeah, absolutely. But we like to remind ourselves that's how like diamonds are, formed from extreme pressure as well. But yeah, why do we start Muskox? We started Muskox because we saw a lot of brands that were ultimately making money from creators. Not that they were taking advantage of them in any way, but through the partnerships, the creator helped to build the brand and to sell the product. And now the brand is making money from that. And we said, well, this was early days where things weren't as common doing this. We said, well, what if the creators really developed the brand? And we had a deal with a large outdoor influencer, Matt Carricker, Demolition Ranch, many millions of followers. And we had a deal, kind of fall through to be a sponsor for a camo brand. And deals don't fall apart overnight. But, as it went through the undulations of a deal, as it may, we said, if this falls through, maybe we should just start our own brand. I don't even know that we need to partner with this existing brand. Well, Fortunately or unfortunately, that deal did fall through. And we said, hey, why don't we launch a new brand? And so we did. And the whole premise behind it was for the Out Loud group was this is basically a test case for being able to launch new brands and partnerships with creators. And so we saw it as very connected to our business, although on the surface you say, what the heck is an influencer agency doing launching its own flannel brand? That's a valid question, but we still to this day see those as, you know, very interconnected.
And this is not like, I'm looking at the site. It is not just slapped together. This is a really nice, nice looking site. And it has a message to it. And like, it's a lot of custom illustrations. You know, I need another flannel. Like, you know, I need an extra hole in my head, but you could convince me.
Well, thank you. We won't turn this into a sales pitch, but you know, we have won best overall flannel by Gear Junkie for the last 4 years. And sadly, oh, wow. I have to say that we did not pay for that since it's 2026, and you can pay to get the best of for a lot. That's completely, you know, organic recognition. But yeah, thanks. It's taken a lot of twists and turns, and happy to share this story, but probably not super relevant here. The creator that we originally partnered with, between the time we said yes and the time that we actually had flannels, he had a challenge with a knife brand that he had launched and just didn't feel good going public with anything new because he didn't want his audience to ever feel like they were taking advantage of them. We had managed Matt for years, since day managed Matt, even though he's retired. So relationship's great. He advocated for the brand, but didn't feel like he could be, you know, externally the owner of the brand. He's not the owner behind the scenes now either. So it's taken a lot of twists and turns, as any business does, but it's been a fantastic sandbox for us to experiment with and continue to push the envelope for our brand partners, where if there's something new and different and we're not certain about it, we'll try it with Muskox. And that's helped Muskox a lot. And I think has helped our brand partners pretty significantly as well.
It's nice to have that sandbox to play with. It's also nice to have, that social proof, right? If I have a brand, I have a Shopify store, and I'm hiring, you know, a service partner, a marketer, the case study's helpful, you know, all that proof is helpful, but then you putting yourself in my shoes in this very real way, that I think adds a lot of credibility. You know, I've gotten that a lot. People are like, oh, do you have your own store? I'm like, no, man, that sounds really hard. I know too much.
That's true. I mean,
oh, yeah. I don't have time for that. Are you kidding me? It's not easy. I'm just aware of the work that goes into it because I'm part of that work. But okay, I want to talk about how to think about influencers and content creators. You know, many years ago now at this point, like 6 years ago, someone said to me, hey, I think, you know, in the near future, every brand is going to have to think about themselves as their own little TV station, you know, their own little TV studio that has to produce content. And I suspect, you know, that's probably your approach as well. But the influencers are the ones that you go to get that content. But talk me through it. Like, if I'm the brand, how are we thinking about, you know, these folks and these relationships?
Yeah, I like to think of creators as decentralized media companies. When you're a brand and you think about that, I think it's a little easier to recognize their power and their influence. And so if you were to zoom back, you know, geez, now 40 plus years, you know, there was ABC, NBC, CBS, and maybe Fox as like the primary video-based media outlets. And that evolved to being cable and having a 42 channels in ESPN and USA, right? And now it's evolved to having Instagram, TikTok, you know, YouTube. It's kind of sort of podcast on video now as well. And you have thousands and thousands of creators who are at scale, right? Like it'd be hundreds of thousands if you're not talking about scale. But at the end of the day, it's really helped for everyone to be able to find their community. But at the end of the day, like, these creators are still massive media outlets, right? For brands to be able to connect with. And I think it's really important for brands to just recognize the power that creators have, and, you know, how in a world where we all hate, you know, being sold to and we hate ad blockers, we actually want to hear the opinions of influencers, and influencers are so great at, you know, being able to really understand a value proposition, beta testing, because I don't think brands do enough. It's like early in the process, if you're launching a new product, bring creators in, even if your creators aren't developing the product, which is great if you do that, but have them be the first ones to test it. Because as we know, it's one thing to understand something, and it's another to understand it well enough to explain it to someone else. And creators inherently have to explain it well enough to their audiences. You know, and I'm sure can personally relate to, Kurt. And so I think, you know, brands need to understand the power of creators and just pause for a moment when before they're partnering or figuring out what they're doing and think about how they can use creators holistically. Because I mean, the trends and the impact that influencers have on preferences and buying decisions is just massive. And I feel like a lot of times folks are still stuck in a singular viewpoint of how creators can or should impact those decisions around perception or purchases.
Here's a word from our sponsor, Zipify. Hey, the holidays are over. Traffic's down, ad costs are still up, and you're staring at Q1 wondering how to keep momentum going. Here's the move. Stop leaving money on the table with every order. One-click upsell automatically increases average order value by up to 30% with AI-powered upsells across your entire customer funnel. Launch pre-purchase and post-purchase upsells for every product in your store in one click. Customers get personalized offers and spend more as a result. Unlike other apps, you only pay for those results, not views. It takes under 2 minutes to set up, and it starts working immediately. Q1 doesn't have to be a slump. Make every order count while you rebuild traffic. Go to Zipify.com/Kurt for your 30-day free trial. That's Zipify.com/KURT. And let's start the year profitable. You know, when approaching those relationships, how do merchants get it wrong? You know, is it just like, hey, they show up too hot? And they're like, hey, look, I'll just give you $500. Just start plugging my stuff on, you know, whatever, on your YouTube channel, whatever.
To start, I think that's getting it right. Right. Just do something with creators.
Okay.
Right? So I think my advice, if you're a merchant and you've never done anything with influencers or creators, is to do something, right? Like if your car is stuck in the snow in the middle of January, and you want to go northeast, don't worry about the direction you're going. Your car's stuck in the snow. Just start rocking and get some movement. Once you get on the road, then you can worry about going northeast. So start to work with creators. Ask questions, see what they like, see what it does to your audience. There's sort of like no bad first step you could take would be my contrarian take there. But then in terms of what they get wrong, I feel like a lot of times brands can try to see creators as extension of their brand voice as opposed to brand advocates. So it's really simple. Like, let the creators say what they want to about your product. Don't try to tell them like, hey, talk about exactly how soft the flannel is and that this locker loop's great and we won these awards, right? Like, just say, share your honest opinion about the flannel, go. Because then they're advocating for your product, which is what they're good at, as opposed to trying to be an extension of like your brand voice. So I think that's one thing that we see, you know, merchants that are, you know, starting out get wrong. And we see massive merchants, you know, who have invested a lot of money to get like, you know, the brand proposition and the brand voice and the brand pentameter correct. So I think that's the number one thing that we see merchants doing wrong is trying to force a script or really prescriptive talking points on creators.
Yeah. Well, and I get, you know, the fear there. It's like, I've got this brand and I have to protect it, you know, before we put it out there. But in doing so, trying to protect it, we have kind of the opposite effect. I think especially, you know, when you're going to an influencer, they will have a tendency to be most protective of their audience. They have that, you know, a parasocial relationship with them, but they want to protect them because that is also, you know, their value. It goes both ways. And so to have a brand say, you're going to talk about this in this way, well, that's probably quite antithetical to how most of these people approach producing content. having the best intention on the merchant side, this could still backfire on you. Or it's much easier to go, all right, you know, just get out there, be honest, you know, and just have that brand awareness be the goal, I suppose.
Yeah. And I think you bring up a really important point, right? So when you talk about like, what is the goal, right? If brand awareness is the goal, great. But I think influencer, particularly when you start to, you know, invest real dollars, and real dollars is, you know, a fluid thing, right? Like $100,000 when you're starting out is a massive amount. And once, if you're working for Fortune 500, you know, merchant or something, like, it's probably not a huge investment. But point is, anytime you're starting to deal with, you know, dollars of meaning, you really got to be dialed into what's your objective for the campaign, and be honest with yourself up front, right? Is it awareness? Do people just need to understand about your product and get educated on it? Are you trying to drive conversion? Because the blessing and the curse of influencer marketing is that it is a full funnel program. You can optimize it for conversion. You can optimize it for awareness and everything in between, you know? And a lot of times folks like to think that they're going to look at something more upper or mid funnel, but then the second the results are in, they're only looking at how it did from a conversion perspective, right? We see that so much because it's like, we want to talk about upper funnel, but when push comes to shove, we're only looking at conversion. So the tactics that we would take will be very different depending on what the objectives are, right? And so I think taking some time to really think about why you're doing influencer. I mean, we're all so busy, you know, influencer should be part of your marketing stack. Like, just go, right? Well, you need to pause and really dial in those objectives, because we would, you know, as an agency, we would recommend very different approaches depending on what the objective is.
So what's the right objective? Yeah. How do I think through that?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So let me tell you, and I'll start with what's not the right objective. The right objective is not, our board said we should be on TikTok. So let me call Brad and his team to say what can we do on TikTok. So we see that a lot. That's not an objective. That's a tactic. I think for most brands, if you're starting out and you're in that high growth phase, you need to be laser focused on sales and conversion. And as you continue to grow, you will start to see yourself plateauing from a search perspective and from a paid social perspective. And that's the moment where you need to stop selling product and start building a brand. And from that moment forward, you're going to have a mix of branding being the right objective and conversion being the right objective. And generally, to start, influencers are great because it can be a hybrid. And so if you are listening to this and you're a merchant that's just starting out or still very much in like the figuring out product market fit, or you think you have it and you're still trying to scale it and it's going pretty well, you should be focused on conversion, right? Okay. Like you need people to buy your product. And then once you're trying to evolve, or maybe you're getting into retail now as well, where there's still certain things you can do for attribution we can talk about, but it gets much more challenging, then I think that's the point where you should be looking at, you know, a hybrid approach. And once you get to be, you know, a large organization, then you should have, you know, dedicated campaigns towards just building out and growing the brand, in addition to still having, you know, conversion campaigns and programs as well.
So if typically conversion is the goal, how do we measure it? How do we get attribution on that? Because it gets a little squishy.
Mm-hmm. It can, but it's 2026, and you know, folks should be able to, you know, dial that in a bit more. So I guess because the attribution is a little bit different platform by platform, and I don't want to bore folks by going into too much detail with each. So let me just start with, like, if we're talking about conversion, most cases we are going to be talking about running paid campaigns with influencers on Meta or TikTok. And then also, increasingly, we can do a lot on podcast. And we'll take a quick tangent on podcast, and then we can go back to, you know, Meta. Sure. And TikTok. But podcast has the amazing blessing of the ability to use a pixel. For all intents and purposes, you can't use a pixel on YouTube, Meta or TikTok because they're walled gardens. But on a podcast, you know, when we record this episode and then it gets pushed out, so there's something called an RSS feed. That's how the podcast actually gets out to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or whatever provider.
It's unique in that it gets syndicated across platforms.
Exactly. And as part of that, you can include a pixel in that. So when people are listening to a podcast, what they may not realize is there is a pixel that's dropped. And if you're, if I download the podcast on my phone, and let's say, Kurt, we live in the same place, the pixel is smart enough to know that, like, hey, all these devices are, you know, sleeping at night in the same residence. So if you then make a purchase, you know, a day a week after on your laptop, the day a week after I download it on my phone, again, if we were living in the same residence, the pixel would be able to attribute that conversion to the fact that I downloaded the podcast, right? So it can factor that in. And so the pixel is what makes a lot of brands really gravitate towards podcasting as the next, attributable platform as they're sort of, I don't want to say graduating, but they're, as they're continuing to level up paid social and, you know, paid search. And so that's where podcasts can be extremely powerful.
What about, do we ever use coupons for attribution?
Yes. So where we see coupons being helpful is like we kind of put vanity URLs and coupons in the same bucket, right? And so vanity URLs definitely preferred to coupons because of the, you know, ability of the retail me nots and honeys of the world to be able to pick up those coupon codes. So there's some things that we can do to try to minimize like the leakage of those. But you know, the best practice, you know, as we record this is to have, you know, a vanity URL that someone has to enter into, you know, enter with a, you know, the backslash, you know, unofficial Shopify or whatever the case may be. And then when you enter into that, the discount code or the promo code is auto applied, right? So there's not a promo code that's out there. And so it's much harder for folks to, you know, have like a leaked promo code when there's not actually a promo code. It's just going to a specific URL. So that's what we see, you know, work, you know, typically with a lot of brands that we're partnering with, particularly on, you know, YouTube or Instagram shorts, where you could have it be like more organic content. Meaning the creator might be getting paid, but their audience is organic. When I say organic, I'm just making a distinction between creators posting to their audience, quote unquote organic, versus like paid dollars going out to send the program out.
And so, then go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, going back to sort of the original question, I know I tried to have the podcast be a tangent, but to bring it back in probably too rambling of a way. So I apologize. But when we're talking about like measurement in what we're doing on like Meta or TikTok, there, what we recommend is in short, and we can talk about the details of this too. Sure. Partnering with creators, having it come where if you're a user of the platform, it's showing up as it's coming from the creator as opposed to the brand. But on the back end, you have the accounts linked, you know, creator listing, allow listing. We really don't use the term whitelist anymore, but it all means the same thing. Where we're able to attribute every single, you know, sale using like the power of like the Facebook / you know, Meta algorithm and similarly for TikTok, where that attribution on a per creator and per sale level is quite strong. Imperfect, but quite strong.
Here's some customer service emails you don't want to wake up to. I was drunk. This was a gift, but we broke up. Wrong color, wrong size, wrong me. Sound familiar? With Cleverific, you don't have to deal with these anymore. Cleverific gives your customers a self-service portal to edit their own orders. No emails, no back and forth, just simple fixes. Fewer support tickets, faster fulfillment, and happier customers. Peter Manning New York slashed their order support request by 99%. You can too. Get 50% off the Cleverific Pro plan, just $49 a month, exclusively for the unofficial Shopify podcast listeners. Go to cleverific.com/unofficial and use promo code KURT50. Fix the problem before it's a problem. That's Cleverific. You mentioned whitelisting. That's its own topic, where whitelisting, you know, I have not done this personally. It's been a long time since I've been willing to, you know, enter the minefield that is running performance ads. But with a whitelisting, I understand as the brand, I'm able to run ads through the creator's handle.
You got it. So taking a step back.
That seems powerful.
It is powerful. On average, and this doesn't mean this is what you're going to see for your brand, but on average and aggregate, we see about a 15% increase still today in terms of conversion efficiency when we're running campaigns coming from the creator's handle versus coming from the brand's handle. So there's three kind of ads that you can do, sort of like performance, you know, paid social here. Number one, you can run, you know, ads from your own Facebook account. You can boost posts that you've done, or probably, you know, more likely, you know, more savvy is you're going into your own, you know, business account and you're running paid ads coming from your own company, right? So say Muskox Flannels, we run paid ads where as you're scrolling, it's coming from the brand Muskox. The second thing is allow listing or creator listing or whitelisting, whatever term we want to use, it all means the same thing, where exactly like you said, it's coming from the creator's handle. And I'll talk about how to do that in just a second. But then the third thing that's pretty new and we're seeing really good results with is collaboration posts or content where it is showing up from both the brand and the creator's account. And that seems to work really well. And that's true for like organic post or paid. But I think where there's a huge opportunity for merchants is really working on like creator listing, right? And so if we want to get granular, I can kind of walk through how you actually can do that.
Please do.
Okay, so the first thing, and this may be obvious, but I want to start at the beginning, is like you really need to have a business account for your brand. And for any creator that you're working with, the creator can't be developing an account on a personal or individual account. They have to have a business account as well, right? So that we'll just pick on Meta for this, because Meta is still the most common, right? So you got to, you know, through the have an account that exists where you can operate through the Meta business suite. And so once that happens, you know, generally the flow would be the creator actually creates the piece of content, and they can post it or not post it, but now that piece of content is living in their account. And then the creator needs to, first generally what will happen is the brand will request access to a Facebook page. So you go into your business account, you request access to a Facebook page, you find the creator, right? You enter in their page URL and you make a request. Now, I will put a quick caveat out there. Like, yes, if I want to be like, you know, glass half full, they get a notification, they get an email. It's really seamless. And all that's true. But the reality is creators get inundated with spam. They get inundated with requests. The notifications are probably at 253. Like, they're not necessarily going to see it. So you definitely need to stay in close communication with the creator to make sure they're taking a look and actually going in and approving that request from the brand. And then once you've done that and you've gotten that approval from the brand, from the creator, you need to go in and make sure you have access to the correct assets from the creator's account. And you have to be careful and granular, because Instagram is considered an asset, Facebook is considered an asset, the content is an asset, the audience is an asset. And then you need to figure out like what individual pieces of content you want to run, and the creator will approve specific pieces of content for you. So once you get all that set up, which this is really just, you know, the longer version of how do you link the creator and the brand's account, then it becomes pretty straightforward. You're going to go into your ads manager, you're going to create a campaign, figure out the audience. You want to use the creator's audience, which you now have access to. And generally speaking, like a lookalike audience, you're going to choose your objective for the campaign and, you know, go about, you know, getting things ready for actually executing a campaign just like you would. And then most importantly, at the very end, you select which page, meaning the brand's page or the creator's page, that you want to run the campaign through. And so you, of course, I shouldn't say of course, but generally speaking, you're going to want to choose the creator's page to make sure when someone's scrolling, they see it coming from the creator. And so that's really how you set up allow listing. And to your point earlier, Kurt, I mean, this is super powerful. And it's powerful because you're harnessing the credibility of the creator when someone sees that it's coming from the creator. And it's also, so that's great from a brand perspective, but from a creator, especially smaller creators, now you're getting paid dollars. You're seeing, a lot of people are seeing this content for the first time, and it's really easy for you to click to the creator's page and to, you know, possibly follow them as well. So it can be really a win for creators, especially up and coming creators as well. And still we're seeing brands really underutilize this technique. And
I suppose I'm also not looking for it, but I just don't see this one a lot. It sounds awesome. You know, and my pushback on it was going to be, you know, what does the creator get out of this? But you spell that out for me. Like, okay, they get expanded reach. You know, the other thing I found, some people who have not done sponsorships, advertisements, you know, partnership relationships like this before may be resistant to it on the creator side because they want to protect, you know, that equity that they've built. But sometimes adding that advertising, having those sponsorships, makes you look more professional, makes you look, you know, add some validity to it. And it could actually be helpful, assuming, you know, it makes sense for the audience.
Yeah, it's got to be a good fit from both sides. It is funny. I mean, there's plenty of stories out there about creators like faking a Nike partnership and so forth. Generally, these are, you know, established credible brands. And then sometimes these creators will actually get in hot water, which does happen, right?
I've heard, I read an article, probably like over the pandemic, that high schoolers were faking sponsorships to impress their friends. Like, oh man, right. What a weird world.
I know. It is weird. It's funny. That can actually be bad for brands when one of those creators does get, you know, find themselves involved in a scandal and they have to kind of say, I actually be never partnered with this individual. So it can get sticky for sure. But, you know, you just got to do your homework and you got to make sure you feel good about a fit with a creator. And when you do that, it really does work well for both parties. I mean, you kind of, it's like the classic Venn diagram. What's the overlap in the circle? What's good for the creator? What's good for the brand? And as an agency, I mean, that's really a lot of what we do is troubleshooting and problem solving and trying to really make sure we're finding that spot. Sometimes it's very narrow. Sometimes it's very wide where there's, you know, value that's created for the brand and the creator.
So when you're trying to find that fit between, like, your clients are the brands, and you're trying to find, you know, the right creator for them. What are we looking for?
Yeah, so we have we have a great position of having a ton of proprietary data as an agency. So I'll walk through that really quickly, and then talk about what you can do if you're not working with an agency too, because there's things you can do. So as an agency, you know, we've been operating for years and years and years, and we have a ton of performance data. So we're talking about creators who work well. We actually can say, like, look at a creator and say, oh, they're the 85th percentile working with brand X. They're the 70th percentile working with brand Y. They're the 50th percentile working with brand Z. We can see all this data, which gives us a very, you know, strong competitive advantage to say, hey, this creator has worked really well for brands in the past. And, you know, historical performance is the best indicator of future performance, at least from our perspective. So we can identify those creators who worked really well for brands in the past, and we can get very granular with that. If you don't, you know, if you're not in a position to hire an agency and you're doing this on your own, here's what you can do. Look for creators that have been renewed by brands on a repeat basis. So brands are smart. If something's not working with a creator, they're probably not going to renew with that brand. But if you see that they've worked with a creator, the creator has worked with a brand for a year, and you dig a little deeper and you find out there's actually three brands that they've worked with for a year, that's a pretty darn good indicator that that creator has the trust of their audience, again, in a world where people hate to be sold to and use ad blockers all the time. So that would be a very good signal that that creator is going to be, you know, good for you. The flip side of that is actually like up and coming creators, if they haven't done any brand deals or very, very limited, you know, the bigger a creator you can get that hasn't done brand deals can be great because the audience really wants to support that. Like back in the day, it was like, oh, you're selling out. Now it's a celebration. Like, oh, amazing. Like, congratulations. And they're going to want to really support that creator. But you got to do your homework on that because if someone had tried with like 3, 4, 5, 6 brands and hadn't been renewed, there's pretty good chance that they're actually just not that effective in moving the needle for those brands. So that's sort of I don't want to call it a hacky, but that's the, you know, low tech way that you can try to get a sense of the creator's ability to perform for brands.
So, okay, if I want to get into this, is there a minimum revenue level I should be at? Because you're like, hey, we worked with AG1. All right, well, that's huge. And you said, well, like, maybe someone's spending $100,000 on an influencer campaign and it's a drop in the bucket. All right, that's not a drop in the bucket for most of us. But then you've got Muskox Flannel, which I think, did we say that this is doing $1 million a year?
Yeah, a little bit under $1 million. Yep.
So we're like, all right, there's a range there. At what point does it make sense?
There's such a wide disparity in terms of when it makes sense.
I essentially asked you, hey, what does a house cost?
Well, look, here's what I would say is that there's no reason to not experiment with influencers, but this is not the best analogy, but I like to say, you know, don't do a one rat study. Meaning, like, you're not going to learn anything if you partner with one influencer. Like, if it does great, you might have just gotten lucky. And now if you're, you know, 10xing your investment and you're like doing the math, like, you may not be able to replicate that. So you want to work with enough creators in testing something that you're going to really be able to learn if something's like a repeatable and scalable channel. So generally speaking, you know, we're working with brands that we're saying, hey, work with 8 to 10 creators as initial starting point, whatever that may mean. And so if you're, you know, earlier in your journey as a merchant, then you can probably go a little bit smaller. You can work to 5 to 6 creators and get them just to create content and be able to do, you know, creator listing, allow listing, where it's hopefully making your paid social more effective. And if that's the case, then go a little bit wider, maybe get a little bit bigger creators over time and see if you're able to still keep that, you know, that momentum or that uptick in terms of your conversion rate or your, you know, your acquisition cost or AOV, whatever metric you're seeing that improvement on, and, you know, keep pushing that envelope. So, I mean, you can start, I mean, if you're truly looking for content creation versus influencers, and let me unpack that as distinction quickly. Influencers are people who have influence, meaning they have a following, people care about what they say. Content creators, they develop content, but they don't necessarily have a big audience. So generally speaking, we say a creator, it's someone who probably has a couple thousand followers, but they do a good job of creating content. You can have them, you know, create a piece of content for you for a couple $100s. And then go ahead and use that for your paid social. So if you're small, like you could get this going for $1,000, right? Where you're working with, you know, 4, 5, 6 creators, have them develop the content and then put them into your paid social, and you're going to get a read, you know, pretty quickly in terms of how well that's working for you. Again, like if you're more mature as a merchant and you got to have your paid social and paid search humming, That's probably the time to look at working with creators to have them post organically and creators who are at scale. And you probably want to start in like the 50 to 75K of an investment with those creators. But same approach, like you'd probably want 8 to 10 creators, but now you're working with creators who have between like 30,000 and 100,000 views per piece of content, where they're truly influencers, as opposed to when we were talking about if you're a smaller merchant and just starting with influencers / creators, you're probably working with creators who you're paying a couple hundred bucks for a piece of content with.
You know, for me, really, like, you know, we've been talking 40 minutes. Looking back over our conversation, the standout takeaway for me, my aha moment is whitelisting. I think that's like the really powerful, somewhat technical component that, you know, especially smaller brands running influencer campaigns may not realize that they're missing out on. So if you're already running these influencer campaigns and you're not whitelisting, that I think is the magic ad or push. And if you're not doing it at all, now you've given us a framework for getting into it. You know, find these smaller creators, micro influencers, we used to call them, pay them for pieces of content that you could use on paid social and get like a variety of this great, authentic, good content and start building that relationship. Okay. I like that.
I think you nailed it. And I would just add one thing that we didn't talk a lot about, and I'll be quick on this, is that these collaboration posts are fairly new. They're doing really well. And so it's another form of the whitelisting, but instead of coming from the creator, it comes from the brand and the creator. It will require a second set of approval, right? In this business manager. So first you have to approve the organic post, and then second, both parties would have to approve the paid behind it. But ultimately, it's whitelisting. It just shows up as a collab as opposed to from the creator. And if you're going to invest in whitelisting, I would, you know, definitely encourage folks to also like look at doing the collab posts, because they're less common and they're off to a really good start. And I'm pretty bullish on that here in 26.
Beautiful. 100%. Brad, where could people find more about you?
So you can visit us at theoutloudgroup.com. Maybe it redirects. Sorry. Just outloudgroup.com. You can, you know, find more about us. We have a whole bunch of information and insights around influencer marketing on our page. And certainly you can, you know, reach out to us, and we're always happy to have a chat with brands to try to steer you in the right direction in terms of your influencer work.
Beautiful. Brad Hoos, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kurt. Appreciate it.
Hey, before you go, I was hoping you would check out our new app, Promo Party Pro. It is what I want to be the single best, easiest way to run a free gift with purchase promo on Shopify. We just put it live in the App Store. We've got less than 50 users. We want your feedback. So if you need to run a free gift with purchase promo in the near future, install it, try it. There's a live chat. I check that all the time. And so if you have any issues at all, you know, or any suggestions on how we can make it even easier to use, let us know. We're happy to help. If you want to try it, search Promo Party in the App Store. Promo Party Pro is the app. Give it a shot. It's got a free trial. Thanks.